Welcome to episode 99 of the Cycling Europe podcast. My name is Andrew Sykes. We're nearly there. We're nearly at number 100. More about that, perhaps at the end of this podcast. But in a few moments, we're going to be listening to a chap called Gerald Huber. He's Austrian, but he lives in Paris, and he's going to be talking about cycling the North Cape 4000, which is a ultra long distance race from Italy up to the northernmost point of Europe. But just while you're here, don't forget that you can get in contact with the podcast by visiting cyclingeurope.org/contact. That's what Gerald did a couple of months ago. And you can support the podcast by visiting cyclingeurope.org/support. So, without further ado, here's Gerald, and I started by asking him to introduce himself.
So I'm Gerald. I'm living in Paris since over 20 years now. Originally, I'm from Austria, and I'm having a normal office job in Paris in a pharma company working in finance. I'm married. I have two teenage kids. And thanks for inviting me.
And how would you describe your style of cycling?
Actually, I would define myself as a commuter first. I'm cycling since always, and commuting to work since many, many, many years. And nine years ago, I got my first road or gravel bike, and then I started to do some real road racing. Doing some distances, 80, 90, 100, and then I did my first 200 kilometers, and I took pleasure in riding longer and longer rides. First in groups and then on my own, doing the one-way group and then alone back or things like that. So I'm an ambitious commuter, I would say.
Yeah, and I've got your Strava account here in front of me. Your longest ride, you are into long-distance cycling. It says here your longest ride was 530 kilometres. Was that part of the North Cape 4000 that we're going to talk about?
No, actually it was my brother has an apartment in Belgium, so I took several trips cycling from Paris to the northern tip of Belgium. And once I decided, I want to try 500. I did several times 400, and then 500 means riding in the night and riding back. I missed the last train, and then I was obliged to finish, and that was just on my own, riding through the night, and it was fantastic.
So when you signed up for the North Cape 4000, you weren't a complete novice in terms of cycling long distances. That's fairly clear from your Strava account. Can you just describe what the North Cape 4000 is?
So it's organized by an Italian organizing team. I think they're doing it since the eighth edition, I think. They call it a challenge. They don't call it a race. I think it's for endurance reasons or something. But it's an unsupported challenge with a fixed route. Means participants are gathering together at the starting point in Italy. It's always in Italy. This, when I participated, it was in Rovereto, which is close to the Garda Lake in the northern of Italy. And we have a fixed route, so they're providing GPX files up to the North Cape. So the finish is always in the North Cape. So it's always Italy, North Cape. 4,000 kilometers in average. It includes a ferry crossing. Every year they are changing slightly the route. So the year before, I think they went through Paris, France, and the start was more to Milan. It's a fixed route, so everybody follows the same route, and everybody is organizing himself or herself in terms of accommodation and obviously eating and mechanicals, and everything has to be taken care of yourself. And it's allowed to ride together. which is very nice for to get to know people. Me, because how many participants were there? Hundreds, hundreds, for sure. So we start all together some Saturday morning in Italy. Nice atmosphere, and it's really like a mega group ride in the beginning. Everybody has luggage and stuff, and discussing together. And then as the days go on, it gets longer. But when you look into the map, it's like, because they do some kind of live tracking where you can see where each participant is located. It's like a jewelry with pearls, like a collier. How do you say? everybody's more or less meeting again the same people from time to time, and it's really nice to cycle together for some time, and then you can also share a room overnight. Follow where the others are staying overnight, etc. So it's a race. It's a simile race, not super competitive. And what is also special for the North Cape 4000 is there is a minimum and a maximum time. So means you are not allowed to be faster than a given number of days. So for my edition, it was 13 days. You are not allowed to arrive before the 13th day, because they want to avoid that people are riding through the night and overexhausting themselves. So in terms of safety, for them it's safety first. And there are several checkpoints where you get a stamp on your card, and every checkpoint has a minimum time. So you're not allowed to be faster than a given time for each of the checkpoints.
Yeah, it says on the website that it is the most attended ultra distance bike adventure in the world.
Yeah, because there are many, many participants, and it's open to all. They open the registration on a given day, and everybody can register, paying the fee, and there's no examination on you, no qualification process or things like that. So it's just first come, first served, and then you arrive at the start line, and then you go.
So the people who do this, from what you've just said, isn't there a risk that there are some people who are very badly prepared, very potentially unfit, not capable of actually getting to North Cape?
There are all kinds of riders at the starting line, and the allowance of time to make it so to finish it in an official ranking, to be official finisher of the North Cape, is quite large. I think you can take up to 21 days, and then they had some extended time frame to be how do they call it? There was a second list of people who took a little bit more time but still finished. And everybody, I think they say if you can ride 150K a day, you can do this new extended finisher list. Otherwise, if you do 200 kilometers a day, you do it to the official finisher list, I think. So people are knowing, I think, that they need to ride 200K a day, be capable of. And it's a financial commitment, and it's a commitment to go there logistically. So the people that are at the start line, they are quite serious. And they also had a second starting point in Berlin. So those have 3,000 kilometers to go. For those that have less time and want to do it, maybe a little bit shorter. So it's quite inclusive. It's very, very open. And the ages, there were, I think the youngest one maybe 18, 19, up to 70 something. So lots of older guys as well and ladies.
And how many days did it take you?
So myself, I did some testing before, and I thought, maybe I can do every day between 250 and 300K. I did a test one weekend. I took 4 days to do 1000K in May, and I could do it in 3 days. And then, but yeah, I was not sure. And then my wife, she thought, and she didn't tell me, but she told me afterwards that she was convinced I can do it in 13 days or something. And in the end, I did it in 13 days, which is the minimum time. I was not first, but I arrived at the same day as the fastest ones. And I was quite surprised. It was really very well, much better than I expected.
So, what position did you arrive in?
I was in the top 15. Actually, there is not an official ranking. It's just the day where you finished in the official list. And in the end, I was riding with two other riders the last 3 days. We were a three riders team and we arrived together more or less. So 15th or something.
So you're following a route that you can't deviate from the route, presumably. Are there penalties if you do deviate from the route and go slightly different way?
So, of course, you have to deviate from the rule to take a hotel room or to get to a restaurant, etc. And you're supposed to go back to the point where you left the track and then you continue. Let me think. In the briefing, they mentioned that. No, I don't think they have a time penalty. It's not really a race, so there is a principle of honor, I think, but. No, I don't think they have this system of penalties or something like that.
And to what extent did you actually plan it, or could you plan it? Could you book in advance the hotels? Did you know where you were going to stop, or was it very much arrive in a particular place and then just find a hotel?
It's a very good question because I was not sure at all how I should do this accommodation thing. I started with the sleeping bag and the mattress in case to do bikepacking, sleeping in rough. And I knew when I had a booking for the night before the start, and then I knew the first night I could sleep in my brother's home in Munich, which is a bit far from the track, but then my mind was in peace for the first day. And then the first day was going quite well, and I pushed to Munich. So first night was settled, my brother's home, and then the second night I said, "Yeah, no, how will I do it?" I didn't book anything in advance. It was second day was a Sunday. I was in Germany, so from north of Munich, and then as the day went on, I asked the other riders how they are managing, and they said, "Oh, they will look later. They will book something." And then 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I took out my phone and at the bus stop, I started to open booking.com, for example, the web pages, and I didn't find anything on the track. I said, "Ah." And then I looked in Google Maps to see if there are any hotels, and then I started to call them. First hotel said, too late, reception desk already closed. The other said, "No, we don't take people from Sunday to Monday." And it was really getting difficult. And then luckily I'm speaking German, so I found a hotel. And so Germany was quite complicated because you always had to call them. And the second night I called them in the morning already to have something in the evening. So I got in the routine of checking in the morning for sleeping at night. So this was for me, was working well for me. And in Scandinavia, there was no problem at all because it went very well with the web services.
And did you or did anybody take a tent with them, carry a tent and camp?
There was one guy. There was a German influencer guy, Fritz Meinecke. And we learned afterwards that he's really a big influencer in German-speaking market. And he had a tent, like a minimalistic tent, but there were some people sleeping rough, but more bus shelter style, I think. So some really slept out a lot. There was also a participant rider from Malaysia, Indonesia, from East Asia. And he was sleeping rough every day because we overtook him every day, and every day he was turning up again, and he was always sleeping off. It's very funny in the North Cape where people are meeting each other again and again, and rumors or stories are passing from one group to the other. So it's very community style riding. And North Cape is like a big rumor room discussion group, actually. It's really very nice.
And what kind of bike were you using?
So I was the only one, and I think I was the only one since many years that took a time trial bike. And the reason is, it's like a triathlon bike, with extension bars, and you don't have this road bike handlebars. It's more like a triathlon bike, a TT bike, as you say in English. And I took this because I bought it 4 or 5 years ago, and I used it for my own personal long distance races. And it seems a bit counterproductive to use it for several days, but actually I'm quite comfortable on it. I have a good, I fitted it myself to be comfortable, and it's incredibly efficient in terms of effort you put in and speed and distance you get out. So comparing to other riders, I rode less hours per day, but my average speed was higher, and in the end I was progressing like this. I was sleeping longer at night and cycling faster at day. And I'm not the youngest rider, and I'm not the fastest and not the strongest, but I had probably the most efficient bike. And for the luggage, I found there is a system where you have like a bag which has like a frame that you put on the axis, on the rear axis, which is really very convenient, and you can use it for every kind of bike. So the most perfect bike was perfect.
Did you just try and eat a very calorific diet, lots of carbohydrates, or?
That's a good point, because sleep and eat are very important in those kind of events. It's some people call it eating competition because you have to fuel yourself and you have to be able to get the calories in. So I started in Italy with my bike loaded with gels and bars and stuff like that. So the first day I just stopped to have some sandwiches in Italy, or some normal food from bakeries. And then I was lucky that I could stay with my sister-in-law and my brother, and they provided a super breakfast, and I took sandwiches for the day. And then it really started to get more. I had to take care of my own the second and third days. So usually we stopped, and most of the riders, we stopped at bakeries, petrol stations, and supermarkets to buy convenient food that you can eat while riding. So my strategy was to eat all the time and to eat what I like to eat, so where I have appetite. And in the evenings, once the hotel was booked, and if I had time, I went to eat something warm, often together with other riders, or we met by chance close to the hotels, because we all had the same route, and mostly every time in the hotel I met other riders. And in Germany, so it was, yeah, normal. I ate lots of Haribos and jelly bars, gummy bears, things like that. And then in Scandinavia, you get those salty variants. They like the salty ones, and also the acid ones. And I think it was the third or fourth day, I ate too much of them, and my mouth got raw in the inside because of those acid stuff. And it's nice because you don't get in touch a lot with the locals, but then you see the supermarkets changing, and the supermarket of Sweden, etc., and taking lots of liquid yogurt, drink yogurt, and stuff like that. But always what you can eat, whether when you go out of the supermarket, you stuff it in your mouth, or you eat it while riding. And so, but only normal stuff, because as much as possible, and always eating, and mostly cold, and maybe not very healthy, because you just eat what you find, what you can buy, and what you can put into your pockets.
I've just been this morning to the weekly park run in my local town. I know you don't have park run in France because they ban it. But are you familiar with what the park run is?
Yeah, I have an Australian mate, and I see on Strava he's doing those, yeah.
Yeah. And the people who organise it, they go out of their way to say, it's not a race, it's not a race. But I guarantee that everybody who attends the parkrun is very keen to get a very good time. And it is impossible to eliminate the idea that the park run is, on at least some level, for most people, a race, either against themselves or obviously against other people. Now, despite what the organisers of the North Cape 4000 say, it must be impossible to eliminate the competitive element of it. You presumably did feel as though you were competing against other people.
Yeah, you get in the game, and they have live tracking. They have live tracking ranked by progress. So you have a ranking. and discussing with the riders, everybody, because there's this ferry crossing from Germany to Sweden. And then once in Scandinavia, the race for me started. Then I thought, okay, now I'm feeling good, I'm feeling great. I had some mechanical issues in Germany, and then on the ferry, you get out of the ferry together with, I don't know, maybe we were 20 or 30, and then it's a race of people getting out of the ferry the same day. But you're racing together because it's always teams. There's nobody not letting draft behind or something, because it's really collaborative. But of course, you look at where do I stand, and people at home are looking into the ranking and say, "Ah, you go on. There's a guy just 10 kilometers before you. Maybe you can catch him up." And you get caught by the game, and it's very fun. It's motivating. There's no prize in the end, but it's a game. There is.
And if you see somebody at the top of the next hill, do you instinctively just try and catch them?
I'm lucky that I'm a German speaker, obviously, and I'm speaking French because I'm living in France, and a little bit of Italian. And I chatted with everybody from the beginning. I just asked, where you come from, dove sei, de où, et cetera. So in French, everybody knew me because of the bike, because it's a bit outstanding. And then I was the guy on the TT bike. And you recognize names and numbers, and then people you want to catch up, and then you chat a bit. So it's always nice to catch up. You always catch up with those people to discuss. And then there was the Fritz, the influencer, and everybody had the aim to take over, to be faster than him, because he was celebrating this event as the race of his life, etc. So it was really fun. It was also fun in Germany because he was very, very popular, or he is very popular, and there were fans with signposts with his names and running. And as I had more or less the same speed as him, in the beginning I thought they were coming fast, and then I saw Fritz go, and then we understood it's not for us, it's for others. But still nice to have people on the road.
And is he a cycling influencer? Is that his thing?
What I understood is he's like a survival something. So he had his own show, huge production with living outside in the wild, people in the wild or something. And he sold this company, made some money, and now he's entering the ultra cycling scene and going. But he had his camera and everything, so was doing a lot of extra communication stuff.
Right, he sounds like the German Bear Grylls, perhaps. I don't know if you're familiar with Bear Grylls.
Yeah, I think yeah, could be. Yeah. And yeah, so when you see somebody, you want to catch up. Yeah, and especially if it's Fritz, then we wanted to overtake him.
So, what's the attraction? Why? What motivated you to enter it in the first place?
I had a colleague at work who did it, I think, the year or 2 years before, and she said, you should try it. She knew I was in cycling, and we followed on Strava, we were in contact, and then I opportunity came up, and vacation was not planned, and I said, well, I'll try to register, and then I just wanted to do it. And then I got in the dynamics of preparing, and it's also the preparation is an activity on its own, and it's very motivating to have something look forward.
Why did you choose that particular one? Because there is another one, isn't there, which goes from North Cape down to Tarifa?
Actually, I just knew of the North Cape 4000. I knew there are a series called Race Across France, Race Across Switzerland, and all those. But it's shorter, and it's support, semi-supported because you have drop bags for those, and it's a little bit more complicated. And the North Cape, what attracted me is that it seems to be very open, long distance. I wanted to do really the long distance, and I've never been to Scandinavia before, so it also this was also motivating to go there. Some region I didn't know. But I didn't search a lot. It was by chance, I guess.
And in terms of it being supported, unsupported, I remember talking to Mark Beaumont. He's the person who rode around the world in the quickest time. And I said to him, I was asking about the world records and the supported world record, unsupported world record, because I, in my mind, I thought there were two different records. And he said, well, actually, no, there is no difference, because it's so difficult to prove what is support and what isn't support. He said there's actually only one world record, whether you're supported or not. How do the organisers, they describe it as unsupported? But if you have a friend in a van, I don't know, a camper van following you, did that happen? Did people have people helping them en route?
I met a younger participant. She was maybe 19, 20, and her father was traveling on a van with her. So she always, every night, she slept in the van with her father. But I think that's perfectly fine for the North Cape 4000 because it's not a race itself, and there's no jealousy. There's no people are not looking. Yeah, it's. Of course, she's missing out a lot of because she's always focused with this relation with her father, and it's not the same because when you are unsupported, you are much more open-minded. I think that's the spirit that you every day you live a mini adventure and you organize yourself, and it just turns out to be adventure for everybody. There were so many stories on the race on the one North Cape 4000 edition that you hear of, I think it's just nicer to be unsupported for yourself.
Perhaps they mean unsupported in the sense that it's not a, obviously you can book an organized holiday where you are guided from one place to the other. Perhaps they mean unsupported in that sense, rather than actually being very strict when it comes to having people help you along the way. What was your highlight? What was the favorite bit, and perhaps on the flip side, the least favorite, most challenging bit of the route?
Let's start with the most unfavorable. I had some stupid mechanical issues in the beginning, and I checked. Obviously, my bike was I thought in top condition, and I was a little bit worried for the brakes because whenever you have disc brakes, hydraulic disc brakes, and you travel, you always have the risk that you have problems with the disc brakes when you arrive at destination. Those were fine, and then I thought everything is okay. And then on the morning of the second day, I got a flat tire. I replaced the inner tube. I thought no problem. And then I had another flat tire. I changed the inner tube again, and I saw that actually the problem was that the rim band moved to the side. It was not fitted perfectly anymore. And this was causing issues, but it was Sunday. I had to replace the rim band. It's not so easy to find something open, and then I could not pump it up to high pressure, and so the tire didn't fit correctly on the rim because there was not enough pressure. I wanted to avoid to get the puncture, and this I spent 3 days like this until Berlin, where I found a shop open. And I bought a new tire, and that new tire didn't fit because it was a different brand, etc. So in the end, once I have fitted this tire issue, then I didn't have any mechanical issues anymore. But it was very annoying to ride for 3 days with a dink, dink, dink. You know, the wheel was not round. It was not perfectly round, and this was really annoying. And we also had rain. 11 days out of the 13 days were at least once raining per day, and then so means wet feet for 11 days. Personally, I didn't have big problems, but some people were really suffering with the feet because wet feet is not nice. And the highlight for me, was in Scandinavia, like 10th day or something. I was more or less alone because a guy with whom I was riding, he had a mechanical issue, the Scottish guy, and I was alone for a full day. It was a long stretch. I didn't buy enough at the last stop. I only had 1 liter of, I thought it was drink yogurt, but it was oat milk. It was horrible. I had to drink 1 liter of oat milk, warm oat milk. I was quite, yeah, it was not in a good mood. And then I booked for the night, and then I saw a message. Ah, Gerald, did you find your room? Do you have a room? Can I share the room with you? Can I sleep? And I said, okay, no problem. It was Florian. No, I asked him, who are you? C'est Florian. It was a guy I met before, but we have a WhatsApp group, all participants. He had my number, and then we met up, and there was also a Swiss guy called Fabio I met before. So we had the night at the same place, and the next morning, everybody, all of the three, we were starting at separate times on their own rhythm. The Swiss guy, he was always leaving at 4 in the morning, Florian at 5, I a little bit later at 6, something like that. And then again, alone on the road. And in Scandinavia, it's really boring. It's very long. Once you have seen the woods, it's the same every day. And then I got a text message, from Florian, the French guy. Yeah, me and Fabio, he sent a screenshot, a photo of a service station. Go there, we will meet you there. And then they waited for me. And it was so nice because it was the proper rest station with a restaurant. And they were at the table and they said, we stopped for you to have a warm meal because you told us you hadn't had a warm meal for, I don't know, 2 or 3 days. And we waited for you. Now we have to get a warm meal. And this was really, really the nicest meal I had because I was just missing the human warmth. And then we decided, okay, we finished together. We had still 2 days to do. And then we cycled the last 2 days together in a group of three. And Fabio and Florian, they were like 15 years younger than me. And so I felt like the old guy in the group. And the Swiss was a German speaker, Florian, a French speaker, but we spoke English together. And then the last 2 days were fantastic. And I have to say, I'm the oldest one, but I was riding in front with my TT bike, and they were behind me drafting because the TT bike is nice to be fast. And then we finished together. So the highlight was this one lunch in the restaurant.
A few years ago, back in 2015, I cycled from Tarifa to Nordkap. I did it in a lot more time than you did it. Certainly not 13 days. It took me, I think, about two and a half, 3 months. And I was taking my time, obviously camping. But the most memorable bit of that journey was probably the final 2 days, where I was approaching the island of North Cape. The weather was dreadful on the penultimate day. But the thing that probably made it the most memorable, and not really for good reasons, is the tunnel at North Cape, which was, if people listening to this are not familiar with undersea tunnels, they're very different to tunnels through mountains. A tunnel through a mountain is basically just one long straight hole through a mountain, whereas an undersea tunnel, because it has to go underneath the sea, is very steep and then very flat and then very steep at the end again because it has to go underneath the sea. And very often in Norway, cyclists were banned from using tunnels because normally there's an alternative. There's a ferry, for example, and if there was a ferry, you couldn't use the tunnel. Some places there wasn't an alternative. There wasn't an alternative road or an alternative way of getting across the water. And in those circumstances, you could use the tunnels. And that was the case with the North Cape Tunnel, because there's no ferry and obviously there's no road, there's no bridge. And it was a very unpleasant experience. It was very frightening. And I remember the sound, because you had no real idea. When you're on a normal road, you can hear cars in the distance and you can tell which direction they're coming from. And you can tell whether they're very close or very far, not just behind you or in front of you, but physically when they get very close, you know whether it's going to be a close pass because you can hear them a lot more. In the North Cape Tunnel, that wasn't the case. It was just, because of all the echoes, it was just really difficult to judge where the cars were coming from, how fast they were coming, whether they were going to kill you. It was just a really unpleasant, scary experience. So how was it for you?
When did you do it? 10 years ago?
2015.
Yeah, so 10 years ago. Because what I have been told is that the lightning was redone and it has been resurfaced. And they said, for you, it was easy. But I have been prepared. So everybody prepared me. In the WhatsApp group with my family, there was a guy who did it 2 times before. And there was this colleague of mine who did it, and both contacted me just before the tunnel. They said, you take all clothes you have on, you have earplugs, take earplugs. And I was with Florian and Fabio, and we did all the same. We put on all the clothes we had, the earplugs, and still I was trembling when I cycled down, because it's really incredibly steep, and it's so fast cold, because outside it's nice and then you go in and 1 second of the other it's super cold, it's freezing cold, and as you said, you lose orientation, and the noise is horrible. Even with the earplugs it was really horrible. Fortunately we were prepared, mentally prepared, because I took a video before of preparing ourselves. We knew it will be horrible and everybody told us, and you're just happy when it's over. And then once arriving, because you have to go back from the North Cape, so you can cycle or you take the. I took the bus because I didn't want to go to do it again. It's really very unpleasant. I don't think it's dangerous because I assume that the drivers know that. I don't know, because there are buses and trucks going as well. And no, I agree. It's really impressive, but it didn't leave a memory, a trauma. It was not traumatic for me.
I remember climbing out of the tunnel and appearing back into the light at the end of the tunnel and just being a feeling of just relief that, that I'd survived and that I hadn't been killed by a truck or a...
Yeah, the steepness is incredible because, as you said, it's not like a tunnel in the mountain, but it's like a mountain in the tunnel, because you go like over a hill, but down and then up again, and a really steep hill. But if I would do it again, I would remove clothes because there are some bays where you can change clothes. There's some space where you can go, and because going up is incredibly steep as well, and you get very hot. And this was not so nice. But otherwise, there's no choice. You have no choice. If you want to go to the North Cape, you have to take the tunnel.
Yeah. When I came back, because obviously I'd arrived at North Cape, I cycled back to Honningsvåg and I took the Hurtigruten ship from Honningsvåg, and that took me all the way back down to Bergen. So I didn't, fortunately, have to go through the tunnel again. When you arrived at North Cape, at Nordkap, it's a very beautiful, isolated place, but there are buildings there. There's a monument, a statue of the globe. What kind of reception did you receive? Were there people from the organization, had they set up a finishing line, or were there other people there to celebrate with?
Yeah, so the organizers, they were traveling, I think they had 2 cars, and so the organizing team was there with a photographer, the head of the organization, and there are only 2 or 3 people there. So they were waiting with the big camera and arriving. And then they invited us to take pictures in front of the globe. Of course, everybody took the same picture and stamp in the stamp book. And they interviewed some of us. And they took a picture of the bike, which was nice as well because it's a good memory. No, there was nothing at all. Actually, we arrived in the evening. Luckily, it was nice weather, but it's a bit of a dis it's not very impressive in my mind. I like the last day, but more the mainland part, not the island itself is, yeah, nothing very impressive for.
Did you see the midnight sun?
No, not 100%. It was in beginning of August. It didn't really get night, but at night I slept. I was sleeping every night on the bed under a roof, so I didn't. Actually, the North Cape race is very nice because you have long days, and that's really an advantage. You don't have the challenge to ride through the night. You can ride for 20 hours without with daylight in Scandinavia. I think that's one of the plus positive things of the North Cape.
So you came back on a coach, and that took you where to Alto?
Yeah, actually, my family. So I have my wife and the kids. They are teenagers. We thought about them meeting me in the North Cape, but the cost would not have been reasonable. It was really a big expense. So we took 1 week of family vacation in Helsinki. The problem was I finished too early. I finished 1 week earlier, and then we had some buffer. So I had a good week on my own. So I took my time. I took a bus back to Rovaniemi. So it was two buses from Norway to Finland, and then Finland. Rovaniemi is a big city in Finland. It's where the Polar Circle begins. And then I took a night train from Rovaniemi to Helsinki, and I met my family in Helsinki, and I flew back from Helsinki to Paris.
What's next? Are you tempted to do the North Cape 4000 again because it's an annual event? Do people do it over and over and over again?
Yeah, actually, there were some repeat participants. Some people are coming back after a pause of a year. I don't feel motivated to do it again because, as we said, it's a fixed route, and the Scandinavian part is not really so. Yeah, no, actually, but still, I got motivated to do again something, and the next step up for me is can only be the transcontinental race, and I applied. I got the number, so this year I will do the transcontinental race, which is unsupported as well, but it's a proper race, and it's a free route race. That means every participant has to plan its own route. So there are mandatory control points and parcours, which are like stretches that everybody needs to do. And just for the fun, they always put in gravel bits, very long gravel bits, some technical bits, just to make people suffer or make it diverse. And there are also real professional racers are participating in this race to win. So I want to try it once at least. So that's my starting point.
And you said there that you applied. So presumably, do you have to meet certain criteria to actually get onto the Transcontinental? I'm on the website now, just having a quick look. Do they reject people who they think are not capable of doing it?
So demand exceeds available seats. That's sure because it's more and more popular. It's the standard of ultra distance racing in Europe. So you can qualify and you get a guaranteed place if you volunteer the year before. They have lots of volunteers because it's a race with very strict rules, and the volunteers have to check those. Have to they have lots of volunteers. Or you apply, and then you have to just tell them why you apply. Did you do something similar before? And then you pay a small fee, you get the rule book, and then you have like an exam, like an online exam that you know how to navigate, how to plan a route, about that you understood their rules. about safety, how to handle stray dogs in the Balkans and things like that. And then several weeks after, you get an email, accepted or not. And I think they reject a lot.
Every year, you mentioned this earlier before we started the recording, every year it's slightly different, is that correct?
Yes, so traditionally it goes from Belgium to the Black Sea, I think. So one point is it's always crossing the Balkans. So Albania, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Sarajevo, Kosovo, countries like that. Then it went from last year it went from Portugal to Bulgaria. And this year it goes for the first time from north to south, from Trondheim to Greece, southern tip of Greece, Kamalata. And so for me, it's nice because it's like doing the same ferry crossing, but then the other way around. And they also do a special ranking for, they call it the green leaderboard, for people who arrive to the starting place on overland travel, so not flying. And also commit to fly back from Greece. Sorry, not to fly back from Greece. So only do overland travel. So I committed. I will do this ranking, the green leaderboard. And I think it's nice because the problem with all those ultra cycling events is people are flying there. And when you multiply it with the number of participants and the number of races that now are everywhere. The CO2 balance is not really, but I think you are traveling mostly by train also, if I understood well, and it takes time and effort, and it's good that they recognize this effort on the green leader on the own leaderboard, because it will take me 3 days to go from Paris to Trondheim and from Flixbus and ferry and coach, and it's not easy.
Yeah, I think I don't like to fly for one, environmental reasons, yes, especially within Europe, where there are alternatives, but also it's just such a pain with the taking a bicycle on a plane. It's just kind of you have to wrap it up and oh goodness knows what. It's not always easy on the train, but it is certainly easier than taking it on a plane. And what kind of training are you, because it is a race, so you've moved from the North Cape 4000, which is not a race, to the Transcontinental, which is a race. So how are you preparing? Are you doing it, is your preparation any different, bearing in mind that you've now entered a race?
So as I mentioned before, I'm a commuter, so I'm a cycle commuter. So what I do, I extend the commute. I have several bikes, and I take the time trial bike now to commute once, twice a week. And I start earlier, and then I do loops. In Paris, we have like several spots where you can loop and train. But I have a full-time job, I have family, I cannot train more. So in terms of volume, I will do the same. And what's important for this transcontinental is the preparation, the route planning. It takes a lot of time because there are so many. It's a different topic, but they have a system of a list of banned roads, so roads that you are not allowed to use, and then you have to double check that you're not on those roads, and you have to use Google Street View to double check everything. It's incredibly complicated. So this counts as preparation as well. It takes as much time as the physical training. And then they say, so the material, the bike is the same as last year, so I'm quite confident on this. What will be new is the sleep, maybe less sleep, because the distance is higher and the terrain is much more hillier than last year. Because North Cape is quite flat, the North Cape route. And it's not complicated at all in terms of there's no gravel, it's only on road. So, but in terms of, and I try to run like you, and we don't have park runs, but my wife is a big runner, and I'm doing also some runs from time to time. Just to be general fit, I think you just need to be able to cycle a full day for several days, for many days, actually.
And presumably for the transcontinental, people do just take a sleeping bag and they will sleep under a bridge or next to a bush. Yeah. People do that, yeah?
Yeah, this is what I read, and I think the problem is also, I was lucky in the North Cape that I was in the top 20, 30 for most of the time, and then it's quite easy to find accommodation because you are not with the hundreds of others. But I heard that those back in the field, they really had troubles to find rooms because everything was booked at the same day for the participant, by the participants. So maybe that's the reason, and then people are preferring, because when you book a room, you lose time when you check in, you have to find the keys, or if it's an Airbnb, to find the code or whatever. And so both have pros and cons. I personally, for me, it's important to have a proper rest in a bed. So if possible, I will try to be under a roof, but I will take a bivy bag in case that I just need to sleep rough for an hour or two. Let's see.
How many kilometers is it?
Well, it depends on the route planning. So I'm, for the moment, it's much too long. I have to fine tune my route, but it's much longer than the 4,000 kilometers in the North Cape. So it's closer to 5,000.
But between Trondheim and Kalamata in Greece, those are the two endpoints. There's only one, two, three, four checkpoints. There's one in Flam in Norway. And then you've got, there's quite a distance to travel before you get to the next one, which is in the Tatra Mountains in Slovakia, and then another one in Sarajevo, and then the final one before you enter Greece is in Albania. So presumably there's quite a bit of variation in terms of the routes that people take, especially, I would have thought, between Flam and Slovakia.
So we are not supposed to discuss the details between participants, so nobody knows what the others are planning, because it's really the unsupported part includes the route planning. So this is, and because of the banned roads, you're more or less pushed to have, so there are some places where everybody has more or less to take the same route. But for example, crossing Poland, everybody will have to cross Poland, and there are several options. Yeah. And in terms of ferries, we have like a space of the Baltic Sea we are allowed to cross. So I think most will take the same ferry. And then, yeah, but that's the spice of the transcontinental is the dot watching. For the dot watchers, then they see a huge cloud of points with different route options. And the cloud goes, expands and then comes together at the checkpoints and the mandatory parkour. And then there are people on gravel bikes with big tires, and then there are participants like me on road bikes.
How do they decide what is a banned road? Obviously motorways and things like that are banned anyway, but how do they decide on what is a banned road?
So in the Balkans, they have experience from the past races, so they know that some roads are just dangerous. Then, for example, they said Poland, we don't allow crossing the E roads or the some kind of codification, some class of roads are forbidden altogether. And then, so they say it's for safety. And sometimes it's to push participants to take a specific option of a specific mountain, and to push them, to nudge them to take a specific option. But mainly it's for safety. Yeah,
because you said earlier before we chatted, the transcontinental race was originally set up by Mike Hall, the British cyclist, who was tragically killed in Australia. You can imagine why perhaps safety is high on their agenda.
Yeah, and it's a race where people are cycling through the night. Some of the, those that want to win, they sleep, I don't know, 1-3 hours per day max. And it's a different kind of event. But coming back to the North Cape, I think the North Cape is really very open to everybody can do it. Every cyclist, let's say, I think most of your usual guests, could do it if they just commit to cycle every day the distance. And I really recommend it to start, well, maybe not to start the very first time to do ultra cycling, but it's quite accessible, I think, for most amateur races.
Yeah, certainly before you do something like the Transcontinental, it's a good idea to do something like the North Cape 4000, which is not a race and you can ultimately just take your time. How long do you think it will take you to get from Trondheim to Kalamata in Greece?
I hope to do it in the. So they have much tighter time gates. Only half of the participants usually make it in time. So first goal to make it in time for the gates, and then for me the big unknown is the condition of the roads in the Balkans. I've been there when I was a kid, but I don't know those countries. And what I see on Google Street View, it can be very rough. So we'll see.
I cycled from Greece along the Adriatic coast up to Trieste back in 2013, and Albanian roads were at the time, and this is now, well, it's 12, 13 years ago, at the time the roads were comically bad, very, very bad condition, and the drivers were just lunatics. But hopefully that has improved in the last 13 years, you'd like to think. But the other thing about Albania, it's a very hilly country. There's the Albanian Alps in the north, which I presume you've got to go through if you're traveling from Sarajevo. And they are phenomenally steep hills, very, very steep hills. They're a bit that in Britain, we don't usually have mountain passes, switchback roads in the hills. They tend to, because our hills are not very big, the engineers have kind of pointed to the top of the hill and said, right, okay, we're going to build a road to the top. And they literally go up quite steeply. But here in Britain, they're not very long. In Albania, there are some significant mountains. And I do remember some very comically, exhaustingly steep hills. So hopefully, I don't know, perhaps they've invested in the network of roads in the mountains since, but I hope for your sake they have, because they were a challenge.
Yeah, I changed the gearing of the bike, so in preparation. But still, and I will bring. I'm hesitating bringing sandals or my trail running shoes, just in case.
Well, good luck with the Transcontinental race when it starts in, I think it's July, isn't it?
Yes, 19th of July.
Yeah. Okay, well, good luck with that, and perhaps when you've done it you can come back and say how it was. But yeah, thank you for agreeing to talk about both of those events. I think I'm not sure whether I would ever be tempted. I just prefer to do things a lot more slowly myself, but it's certainly an alternative way of crossing Europe on a bicycle. So congratulations on having done it, and thank you for talking.
Thank you, Andrew, for inviting me.
And thank you to you, Gerald, for agreeing to come on the podcast and talk about your cycling adventures. He got in contact, like I said at the very beginning, by visiting cyclingeurope.org/contact. So if you'd like to appear on the podcast, then please feel free to get in contact and we can start the discussion. If you'd like to support the podcast, then please visit cyclingeurope.org/support. So that's it. Episode 99 is almost finished, and the next episode will be number 100. I'll try and do something a bit reflective in episode 100, looking back on 99 episodes of the Cycling Europe podcast. I don't quite know how I'm going to do that yet, but hopefully, I'm currently on holiday from school. It's Easter, so hopefully by the end of the Easter holidays, I should have put something together. What I do know is that episode 101 has already been recorded, and that is going to be an interview with Helen Watson. She's a cyclist but also an author, and she has written about her 2009 journey along the Silk Road. Episode 102 potentially might get recorded tomorrow, but anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Thank you for listening to episode 99 of the Cycling Europe podcast. Thank you to Gerald. Thank you to Rob Ainsley, as always, for the music. And I shall be back, hopefully very soon, with episode 100. Thank you for listening, and happy cycling.